Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
All right, the Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively. Newcomers, is there anyone in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would like to welcome you. On Zoom, you can raise your hand and someone will chat with you.
Hey, Scott.
Welcome.
Glad you're here. Okay. Thanks for clarifying, Scott. All right, that's it. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask that those present please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism by taking AA's simple actions. AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institutions, does not wish to engage in any controversy, and neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open big book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step we discussed tonight. And this evening, we are on step one. We'll be doing step one is broken into two parts, the way we cover it. And I'd like you to please welcome our panel this evening. We have James from Portsmouth and Dan from Virginia Beach. All right, I will read the first paragraph, which is from page XXVI, that'd be 26 in Roman numerals, XXVI for anybody following along online. And then the panel will share for a few minutes each on the reading. Step one, part one. The physician who, at our request, gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe, that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality, or were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us, but we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic, which leaves out this physical factor, is incomplete. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little. But as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. All right. Which of you gentlemen would like to share first?
I'll go first.
All right.
I'm James and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, James.
My sobriety date is September 13th, 2020. And I'm going to read something, kind of what he read to start it off also. It's from the doctor's opinion. It's these allergic types can never satisfy, safely use alcohol in any form at all. And once having formed that habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly different to solve. So I'm James and I'm an alcoholic again. And I kind of started young. I grew up with an alcoholic mom. She's part of my story. And I was about 10 years old, and she went to jail one night, and I was about 10 years old, and I was lonely. I didn't understand what was happening to my mom. I didn't understand why she couldn't be there as a mom and why she had to go to jail. And she had vodka around the house because that was her choice to drink. And I was lonely and I was hurt, and I saw that bottle and it was vodka, and I put it to my mouth, and the smell, I didn't like the smell, but once it got to my mouth and it went down my chest, I liked the effect that it took that pain away from me for that night. And, you know, I thought, well, maybe this is how to solve every time I have pain and hurt, was just to grab the bottle because it took away the pain. And, you know, she ended up losing custody of me, and my dad got me. And when I moved down with my dad, when I became 15, 16, I got into middle school and high school, and I started to smoke. And when I wasn't smoking, I was drinking. You know, I wasn't there to go to school. I was there to get messed up. And it got to a point where I had water bottles of vodka to get through the day. And, you know, I don't know how I got caught. It was that guy looking out for me when I didn't know who he was. But, you know, every time I took that drink, I didn't want to stop. I didn't have a limit. When I started drinking, I wasn't going to stop until I was passed out on the floor. And that was my high school years, my middle school years. You know, I found a way to numb that pain when I was a child. And when I got of age as a teenager, that was it. I found my solution. You know, I didn't know that alcohol wasn't good for me, or that I couldn't just stop at one. You know, one wasn't enough. I had to keep on going until I blacked out, you know. And that's kind of where I was. I started young, and it got me into a lot of trouble. And when I came into these rooms, when they told me that, I didn't like that too much. But I looked back and I understand what they were saying. And I had to shut up and I had to listen, because y'all knew what you were talking about, because I didn't have the solution. I thought I did. So that's how I got on that.
Hey, good evening, everyone. My name is Dan Seema. I'm a recovered alcoholic.
Hey, Dan.
And I first want to say it's an honor and a privilege to be speaking on the panel with James tonight. Mike, thank you for chairing. And David, thank you for your service manning the interwebs. And hello, everyone online. By the grace of God and the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been gratefully and happily and contentedly sober since May 13th, 2020. And that's not something I ever thought I would be able to say about myself. If your memory serves you better than mine serves me, then you'll know that I got sober about 2 months into the lockdown when most of AA was online. Mm-hmm. And I share that to say that in my experience, that's a testament to the power of this program, which in my experience has the ability to transcend time, space, and technology. The program was there waiting for me, my desperation, and my willingness. I have a home group. My home group is the Sandbridge Big Book Study. We meet every Tuesday night at 8 o'clock at the Sandbridge Community Chapel. As Uncle Justin says, it's the best home group in Hampton Roads. And if you get a resentment from me saying that, go talk to your sponsor about it. And if you don't have a sponsor, get one. I have a sponsor. My sponsor knows he's my sponsor because I talk to him every single day. I have the great honor and privilege of working with other people in this program, and that means sponsoring them. I do believe in effective sponsorship, and for me, effective sponsorship means reading the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous with other people in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and taking the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous as they are very clearly printed in black and white in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I do have a service position with my home group. I make coffee, and that's nothing I ever thought I would do. I hope you're already hearing a through line that in my recovery, I've been granted the ability to do and say things I never, ever thought I would do or say. The power of this program can change lives as it has changed. When it comes to these couple of paragraphs that we read, I love it so much. I love it so well. Actually, first of all, I wanted to touch on this idea that before we really get into the nitty gritty of step one, I wanted to pay a little bit of homage to what the great speaker Sandy Beach says about step one. And Sandy Beach doesn't focus on the torture and war stories we have about alcohol, because we've all got them. And I'm not here to prove to you that I'm any more or less of an alcoholic than you are, that I've got better or worse war stories than you. I trust that your experience has led you here for a reason, as mine has led me here into the rooms, right? Mm-hmm. Step one for me is about help. Step one, my step one showed me that life is hard. Yeah. And that I don't know how to live life on my own will, in my own way, on my own terms. I don't know how to do that. I need help. My step one showed me that I sought help through the solution of alcohol, that alcohol became my solution for the problems of living and the biggest problem of living I've come to call Dan. So I need help because I can't do life on my own. My step one simply revealed to me that I sought help from alcohol and that help was no longer working. So what happened for me in my story when that solution was no longer working? I sought another solution and I found that solution in the big book and in the rooms of alcoholics. When it comes to this reading, this isn't Dr. Silkworth speaking. These are the authors of the big book speaking about Dr. Silkworth, right? And I love what they're saying, that at our request, he gave us this first letter. Well, we need more from you, Doc, they're saying, even after, right after Doc says, you may rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves. Because the purpose, some of the purpose of the doctor's opinion is to get us, the reader, to buy into this book, to just take stock in what these folks are saying. And Dr. Silkworth is saying, forget about what I got to say. I'm just the expert here. Listen to these people who found a solution among themselves and are successfully getting and staying sober. Listen to what they got to say. And they're like, well, that's fine and good, Doc, but we want more, because you are the expert. And chances are the readers of this book want to know what you have to say. So please, please, please give us more. And in the more that Dr. Silkworth gives us, he lays it out pretty simply that there is a physical component to this thing called alcoholism that he theorized was this allergy. I've come to understand an allergy to be an abnormal reaction to a normal substance, or relatively, right? In this statement, he confirms what we have, who have suffered alcoholic torture, must believe. I don't feel the need to go into the nitty gritty of my alcoholic torture, because I believe you know what that means for you if you're sitting in this room. That the body, and we must believe this, that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal of his mind as his mind. And then it goes on to say, right? It didn't satisfy to be told we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality, that we were outright mental defectives. These things were true, right? Of course we're screwed in the head. Yes, in fact, we are. And that's not the end of the story. The other half of this, as far as Dr. Silkworth is concerned, is that there is this physical allergy that we alcoholics have that non-alcoholics do not. In the readings tonight, I think we're going to get a little bit more into it. Mm-hmm. But I love what the second paragraph that Mike read is saying, that this is just something that we take interest in as alcoholics who have experienced this physical component of alcoholism. Because whether you non-alcoholics or you laymen believe in it, don't really matter. It makes sense to us. And it certainly makes sense to me, because it fills in the gaps of my story. All of those questions I ever had, why do I keep going back to the bottle? How do I keep finding myself on my knees again and again and again, claiming that I don't ever want to do this ever again in my life? And yet there I am the next day, the same day, the next week, the next month, right? It fills in the gaps. Because once I start drinking, I respond to alcohol in a way that non-alcoholics don't. And it's really simple. I want more. That's what I got on that.
All right, section two on page 28 in the Roman numerals. That's XXVIII. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is the manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class, and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These alcoholic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. And once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, they're reliant upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. James?
Yes, sir. I'm James and I'm alcoholic again. You know, it said about these problems, they start to pile up on us and we don't know how to solve them. You know, my solution, like I said, when I shared the first time, my solution was to get drunk and magically my problems would disappear, I thought. But it didn't happen that way. When I drunk, I just added more problems to the plate that I was already trying to solve on my own. And I grew up with a God. I come from a Baptist Christian family, but I was always the black sheep. I was always the one rebelling against the church, rebelling against Bible church. You know, I got kicked out. My grandma had to take me out because they're like, we don't want you in here. You know, we don't want you in here. So, you know, I didn't have a solution to get through life. My solution was to drink, and it was my own self-will. And my own self-will got me into the bad places where I didn't know how to get out. And all I did is, instead of now, you know, having that solution to have a higher power in my life and having number one in my life when stuff goes bad, you know, I would drink to make it worse. You know, I didn't know how to sit there and say, okay, I had a bad day. Let me pray. Let me call my sponsor. Let me write an inventory to see what's wrong with me and look at myself to figure out what's going inside my head to give me that peace and that sanity that we get when we do that. When we look at ourselves and say, okay, there's something going on with me that needs to be talked about. There's something that has come up from the past that I have to deal with, because if I don't, I know what I'm going to do. You know, I didn't know that there was a solution. You know, when I was young, it was like a motorcycle. It was never on the brake. I just kept on going and going and going and going. And, you know, at one point, my family did get tired of me. And at one point, they were over my shit. And, you know, that still didn't stop me, because they weren't going to take away my solution, which was to drink away the problems, you know. So that piling up, you know, it was a lot. It was a lot. And, you know, when I got in these rooms and I learned of a solution the second time, because relapse is part of my story. I had a year and I relapsed because I wasn't ready to face everything in my inventory. It was too much to look in the past and what I was running from since I was a child. And, you know, when I finally had that moment the second time around, and I got on my knees and I said, God, please help. I had that presence of a loving God. It wasn't that childhood God that I got told I was going to go to hell for my wrongs. It was a loving God that they were talking about in these rooms that I never got experienced when I was young. And when I felt that, every problem that was going on in my life, once I worked that inventory and I got a sponsor and I really was honest with myself and I was honest with God, another human being, the problems that I had, they were taken care of, but I had to do the work. It wasn't this gone, vanished, but I put in the work and my problems were gone and I was able to live a happy, joyous, and free life. It wasn't chaotic, because that's what I knew growing up. So when I got older, I thought, you know, my life, that's how you're supposed to be, is chaotic, because I grew up with an alcoholic mother. But when I got in these rooms, I learned it didn't have to be that way, that there was a beautiful life on the other end, and all I had to do was look at myself and admit all the pain and the hurt that I was running from a child. And, you know, I never found that in the church. I went to so many churches around here and I never felt that presence until that night when I was in Maryview and I got on my knees and I finally surrendered the fight that I was fighting since I was 10 years old. You know, so this program, it's beautiful and it does save lives, because I know, I was telling him, you know, if I didn't have this program in my life and I didn't have these principals and these sponsors, I would either be in jail or I'd be dead. You know, this program saves so many people, but you have to be able to do the work and not be afraid to look yourself in the mirror, because that's the hardest thing. You know, taking away the alcohol, that's temporary. That doesn't go to the real problem. When you take away the alcohol, you got to sip those feelings that you've been drinking down for so long. And sometimes for a lot of us, we cannot handle that. And we go back out to drink. But, you know, my story is relapse. You know, I went back out, but I thank God for a lit relapse because it got me honest with myself. You know, I had to get knocked down so many times to finally say, okay, I'm gonna give it to God and I'm gonna stop running my life on my will because it's not working. You know, I was gonna go to jail or death. That was my destination if I didn't get into these rooms and get honest and let God handle everything that I was trying to control. I'll give it to you.
Man, sitting here with the presence of God next to this guy, Dan, recovered alcoholic. You know, another version, if you will, or another way that I've come to understand step one is that it's not that I can't drink. It's that I'm going to drink again and again and again and again and again, and nothing is going to stop me. And I can't stop me, and you can't stop me. Nothing is going to stop me. The one thing that probably can stop me is jail, right? Mm-hmm. Sandy Beach says it's actually easy because, right, it's not that I have a drinking problem, it's I have a not drinking problem, right? My problems really start when I stop drinking. Yep. Because as Dr. Silkworth says, I become so irritable, restless, and discontented, right? Again, my problem is Dan. But as Sandy Beach says, it's easy to not drink, go punch a cop. And it's easy to not drink for a lifetime, go kill a cop, he says. Not me, I didn't say that, he said it. But the point is that in my step one, I come to realize, right, it's not that I can't drink, it's that I'm going to drink because I need my solution. I need a solution. And it was felt like such a massive betrayal when I finally came to actually realize, when it sunk into my heart, into my gut, that my solution of alcohol had turned its back on me and it had abandoned me. And it left me with this feeling of my problems being so great that the only way out I thought was going to be death. If I were to take my own life or just run into a pole or any number of things, right? It felt like such a massive betrayal. And I love what James was talking about, this word surrender. My step one was certainly a form of surrender. When I came to this place of realization, truly, truly realizing it, not just in my head, because in my head, I knew on several counts that alcohol wasn't working for me anymore. And yet I was so desperate for that solution to keep working. I drank myself into this place of quite literally wanting to be dead, right? So my part of my step one was this understanding, not in my head, but in my heart, in my gut. And I didn't have to work hard to get there. Alcohol did that work for me to get me to this place of understanding in my gut, right? This concession to my innermost self that I was a real alcoholic. And it sounded a little bit like this. If I keep drinking, I'm going to die. And I don't know how to live without drinking. So what do I do? And that's when I found myself in the online rooms of AA. And y'all were smiling and greeting me and happy to see me and all this stuff. And I was like, oh, okay. There's really something here. And this was after I had some experiences in the rooms before in which I quite frankly thought, I'm not a real alcoholic. If this 12-step and God step stuff works for you, that's great. But you're not ever going to catch me making coffee before a meeting for y'all and setting up dirty chairs and dirty tables for dirty hands and dirty people. You're not going to catch me doing that. And now it's the highlight of my week that I get to do that, that I get to go to my home group an hour early, set up dirty chairs and dirty tables for dirty hands and dirty people, and make nasty coffee for y'all. I live for it. I live for it, right? But going back to some of what Dr. Silkworth is sharing with us here, again, and I love the how cyclical, you know, the big book is so cyclical. It's so repetitive, right? It really is. So the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. Again, I respond to alcohol as an alcoholic in a way that non-alcoholics do not. That the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. This allows me to understand a little bit more how my mom can take a sip of alcohol and is like, oh, like I'm done, no more for me. And I'm like, you're done, no more for you. Hand it over, sweetheart. I'll do it. I'll drink all that for you and more. One sip and you're done. Right? Because that's the thing too. As an alcoholic, non-alcoholics, this is what I've come to understand too. Non-alcoholics, once they start drinking, lose a sense of control. As an alcoholic, I start drinking, I gain a sense of control. And it's better than anything I could have ever imagined. So it's no wonder I go back to this solution again and again and again and again, even when it's kicking my ass, right? It's no wonder non-alcoholics don't have this experience as far as I've ever heard or am concerned. So no wonder these allergic types, meaning once I start drinking, my body only ever wants more and never less. That's all it means. My body only ever wants more and never less. These allergic types like myself can never, never safely use. So I can use alcohol, just not safely in any form at all. And once having formed the habit, found they cannot break it, can attest. Once having lost their self-confidence, can attest, reliance upon things human, this is where we get the problem thing, right? It felt like such a betrayal, and it felt so redeeming to come into the rooms of other identified alcoholics who were offering me a different solution, who simply said, you know what, Dan, you don't have to do it. You don't. Now, if you want what we got, you have to do what we got. Including taking those 12 steps that you never wanted to take, and including accepting into your heart the God of your understanding that you never wanted. If you want what we got, you are going to have to do it. And not only that, you're going to want to what we do, because this is an experience you will not want to miss. The big book says this is an experience you must not miss. Mm-hmm. And I love, for however suggestive the big book makes itself out to be, it's full of some clear-cut directive words like must, have to, ought to. My big book, it just gets sassier the more I read it. So I can't help but bring in the sass that my big book gives back to me. That's all I got.
All right, thanks, guys. All right, section three. This is also on Roman numeral 28. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks, drinks which they see others taking with impunity. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, and unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery. On the other hand, strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. James?
I'm James, and I'm alcoholic again. I like when it says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. You know, I liked the effect that it took away all the pain and all the hurt, and it was my escape from reality, because if I was drinking, I didn't have to look at the reality of what I was running from, of the pain and the hurt and everything like that. You know, I didn't do it to have a good time. I was drinking so I could escape reality and I could escape that pain, because, you know, in high school, I would look at my friends and you know, they would be done. They would have like one or two beers, and I'd be like, what are y'all doing? The party's just beginning. You know, it'd be 12 o'clock and I'm ready. You know, I'm ready to get so messed up where I'm, you know, sleeping on their couch or bed or whatever. You know, I was ready to go all night. And if that meant into the morning till I passed out, that's what it was. You know, I wasn't drinking because it was fun. And, you know, you're a kid and you're learning about alcohol. and everything like that, I knew around 15 and 16 that I wasn't just a normal drinker. I knew from the way that I liked alcohol and how I felt in my head and in my soul, I knew I was an alcoholic, but I didn't want to admit it because it was so easy just to drink away the troubles of the day or drink away the pain or drink away because someone pissed me off at work. Now I can't go yell at him. You know, it was my solution when somebody made me mad. It was my solution when I was happy. It was my solution when, you know, I had to think about three people that I lost to drugs and alcohol because I didn't want to accept that they were gone. You know, as long as I was drunk, I didn't have to accept that I lost my cousin, my uncle, and my aunt to alcohol. You know, it was easy. I didn't have to think about it. I didn't have to remember their memory because I was too drunk. And that's what I wanted to feel. I wanted that effect of alcohol that it gave me, that it took away everything that I was running from, you know. And I got into these rooms, and what got me was that I got my white chip, my first white chip at the cabin. And what got me, I came in these rooms and people were smiling and laughing. And I'm looking like, why the hell are y'all smiling and laughing? Why are you not mad? You know, why are you not mad? They were happy to be sober. They were happy to know that there was a life without alcohol that was beautiful, that they did whatever it took to stay sober, no matter what happened to them outside of those rooms when stuff happened. They did whatever it took to be sober because they saw how beautiful life was without that alcohol. And, you know, that's what kept me around. That's what got me into these doors. And some nights when I wanted to walk out that door because I didn't like what they were talking about, that's what kept me, because I saw something in these rooms that I never saw in those churches that I grew up at when I was a child with my grandma, you know. And I love this program because it's not, you know, religion is not shoved down your throat. You find God as you understand him when you work the steps and you really get into yourself. You know, nobody's at that door saying, here, read this Bible. You better read it before you go to hell. You know, they don't have that here. You come in and it's love, it's hugs, it's how can we help you? You know, it's, hey, if you're having a rough time at 3 o'clock in the morning, don't be afraid to call me to get you through the night so you don't pick up that drink. You know, it was a love that I never really got to have when my mother was an alcoholic, you know, because I was by myself a lot of times. I mean, I had my aunt and my uncle, but I was by myself. And that comfort and that love and that support when I got into these rooms, it was nothing I've never felt in my life before. And, you know, that step one, knowing that we're powerless, you know, I had to learn that I'm powerless over alcohol, that I'm not more powerful than that bottle, because every time, if I don't do this program, these steps, if that bottle's in front of me, I'm still an alcoholic. I'm still going to pick it up, you know. And I'm blessed tonight, you know, because I'm able to share my strength and my hope with y'all. You know, I'm 3 years sober, and this was my first night that I got asked to speak, you know. And when I first got in these rooms to get out of myself, they talked about service work, make that coffee, come to a meeting, you know, an hour early, speak to people. Man, when they said I had to speak to new people, I did not like that because I didn't like meeting new people. I mean, I was always the kid that was on the playground away from everybody. You know, I didn't want to make new friends. And I hated when I first got in here that I had to speak to you. You know, I just wanted to come in at the last minute, hear what I wanted to hear, and bolt out that door because I didn't want to get close to nobody. I didn't want you to get close to me because I had that wall up so high that I didn't let nobody get close to me. And, you know, that wall came down when I saw the love and the support that I got in these rooms. And even when I relapsed, there are people at that meeting I went that night when I got in Maryview that said, hey, don't have your head down. Have your head up because you came back. You know, a lot of people, they don't come back. They end up dying. And I remember one night I'm an old timer. And I was pissed off and I was angry because life wasn't going the way I wanted to go. You know, I was mad about work. I was mad about this. You know, I was mad because I couldn't control I couldn't control it no more. And I couldn't go get the bottle to ease the aggravation and the irritation and the discontent that I was having with myself, you know. And I had an old timer look at my face and he said, "You need to stop being so ungrateful, because the seat that you're sitting in tonight, somebody had to die for that." Mm-hmm. And when that man told me that, I stopped right in my tracks, because I heard him. I had cotton ears in my ears. But when that man told me to get out of myself, because I was being selfish, because we're alcoholics, we're selfish, we're self-centered. It's about me, not about you. But when that man told me that, I got out of that. And I realized how amazing and how grateful this program is, and how it saves. I mean, the people that don't have nothing. I mean, I came in here with a bag of clothes. I mean, I was going from house to house living. You know, I didn't have nothing come in these rooms at all. But all I knew was that I wanted help, and I could not do this way of life anymore, that I could not keep on trying to play God and try to control everything, because I wanted to control everything. And if you didn't like what I wanted you to do, that made me mad, you know. But I learned in these rooms that there's only one person that can control my life, and that's my God, as I understand him, you know. This program that saved my life, and you know, I'm hearing you speak and stuff like that, and I'm tearing up, because I go back to my first year, and I remember how hard it was to just be okay. You know, when I left the meetings, I wasn't okay, because I had to go outside those rooms and I had to face life, and I didn't know how to face life without alcohol. I didn't know how to face problems without alcohol. You know, I was okay in here for an hour because y'all gave me the tools and the share and everything like that, that made me okay for an hour. But once I got out of those rooms, I had to face life. And, you know, that was scary. But every step of the way, I had somebody call my phone and say, "Hey, you're doing okay? Hey, do you want to go get something to eat?" You know, I always had somebody from the program reach out to me, because they knew that I needed that extra help just to be okay for the night, so I did not go out there and drink and go back into that dark pit that I was in when I got into these rooms. You know, I'm just grateful, you know. And if you're a newcomer, those first 30 days, you know what I did, I went to meeting, you know, when I wasn't at work, I went to meeting after meeting. If that meant I got home at 10:30 at night or 11 o'clock at night, that was fine, you know. But I was so tired that I didn't want to go out there. I was ready to go to bed. But when I went to sleep, I had that peace of mind to be able to fall asleep and not have to reach for that bottle to pass out and fall asleep, because that's how I used to drink. I used to black out and pass out. That was the only way I could drink, you know. But I remember going all night meetings and being able to sit there and fall asleep. And, you know, when I learned I could fall asleep and not wake up and reach for that bottle or have a bottle to put me asleep, I knew right then God was working in my life, and it was the loving God that y'all were talking about. You know, it was just amazing tonight. That's all I got.
Dan, recovered alcoholic. Mm-hmm. I was reminded of, I went to see a substance abuse counselor once, who not for nothing asked me the most ridiculous question you could ever ask an alcoholic. "What are your triggers, Dan?" I said, "Triggers? What triggers? You mean being alive, breathing, it being warm or cool outside, being a human being on the earth? Is that the trigger you're talking about, lady? Because for a truly chronic alcoholic like me, there's no such thing as a trigger." Yeah. Because this is what happens when I don't have the solution of alcohol. I have an alcoholic mind that can turn miracles into misery. Yep. Now, when I'm under the influence of my solution, I can turn misery into miracles. This is one of my favorite passages, because this is the part where I get to say, yay, how much I love alcohol. Because any alcoholic in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous who says they don't love alcohol is a liar, or they're not a real alcoholic. And believe me, in my experience, there are people in these rooms who are not truly chronic alcoholics. I hate to break it to you. I love alcohol because I love what it does for me. And it does a lot for me. When I'm in my cups, baby, you could not meet anyone who's more talented, handsome, friendly, social, talkative, artistic, so on and so forth. There's no one else you'd rather be with than me when I have my solution.
Yep.
Now, when I don't have my solution, you don't want to be around. Now, some of the ways that my solution came back around to bite me in the last year of my drinking, one of my favorite hobbies, even with my solution, one of my favorite hobbies became crying to anyone and everyone who would possibly listen about how miserable and depressed I was. That's what I came to live for in my last year, in the last year of my drinking. See that betrayal? I lost my solution, right? My solution turned its back on me. But when it was working, holy cow, I couldn't get enough of it, right? They cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. We drink essentially because we like the effect produced by alcohol. That's the only reason we drink. The only one. I drink because I like what alcohol does for me. Now, I also have this phenomenon of craving that develops as a result of being allergic to alcohol that, again, simply means once I start drinking, I can't stop because my body only ever wants more and never less, right? But this sensation that I love so much, it's so elusive, it is injurious. After a time, I can't differentiate the truth from the false. It only makes sense to me that I would get wasted behind the wheel of a car because my drinking gave me special abilities, like being a better driver when I'm drunk. Did it not do that for you? And if it didn't, I'm sorry for you because it was amazing to drive wasted, right? There, it only makes sense that I would get totally obliterated before going to a party so that I could get to the point of total blackout only to be scraped off the floor by anyone who would be willing to take me home. It only makes sense that I would do that. It only makes sense that I would navigate through the trials and tribulations and difficulties of life with the solution of alcohol. That's the only thing that makes sense to a truly chronic alcoholic like me. And so it makes sense that my alcoholic life seemed the only normal one for me. I don't want to be sober. I don't want that because I know what happens when I put down the drink and it ain't pretty. Restless, irritable, and discontented. Need that ease and comfort. Now, this is repeated over and over and over, even after I wake up the next morning with the anxiety that tells me I don't know where my car is. I don't know how much money I spent. I don't know what pictures I sent out. I don't know who I talked to. I don't know where I went. I don't even know who I am half the time, right? I'm never going to do this again. And then 10 minutes later, I'm drinking. Repeated over and over, unless this person can experience, not just think about, live, walk through, experience at a heart and gut level, an entire, not a little bit, not a half, entire psychic of the mind or soul change, there's very little hope of his recovery. Funnily enough, once I get this psychic change, I'm suddenly easily able to control my desire for alcohol. All I have to do is surrender on a daily basis to actionable steps against my better judgment. That's what my grand sponsor says. That's all we ever do. We recovered alcoholics. We do things we don't want to do, right? Some of the reason that I came in here wearing a little button up and a tie is because I was told to. Because in my recovery, I've learned how to follow directions against my better judgment. And when I do that, I experience freedom that I could never experience. I seek humility today, meaning I seek my right size. I'm a drunk and I need help. That's my right size today. Because the minute I start thinking I run this place, I'm in trouble and it's bad trouble. So when I follow these directions, these clear-cut, simple directions from this book with the guidance of another recovered alcoholic, I experience release. Freedom, joy, friendship, friendliness, happiness, serenity. We will come to know serenity by doing things on a daily basis I don't want to do. Thanks for letting me share.
Thanks, guys. All right, the last section we'll cover tonight is on Roman numeral page 30, XXX. All these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. It has never been, by any treatment with which we are familiar, permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. James?
I'm James, and I'm alcoholic again. We talk about, you know, the craving and going back over and over, and when we know what's the end result when we pick up that drink and stuff like that, you know, in that moment when we pick up that drink, we don't care about that because we want to get drunk. We want to either drink enough to get blacked out or drink enough to forget who made us mad or drink enough to forget whatever we're going through. And, you know, I thought I was a normal drinker. You know, my friends in high school, you know, they were able to walk out of the party. They had to drag me out of the party, put me in the car, get a bag, just in case if I threw up. And then when I got to wherever I ended up, they had to put me into the bed. So in my mind, I thought, well, I'm walking out the same way y'all are. You know, I don't understand what's the problem. You know, I didn't think that it was a craving that, you know, I couldn't stop. I thought, you know, I could just have one and nothing bad would happen. But it didn't work like that, because every time I planned to drink a little, I always blacked out drunk. I could tell myself before going to wherever I was going to, okay, you're just going to have two things of vodka or liquor, because what I drink was liquor. I didn't want the wine because that wasn't strong enough. I didn't want the beer because it tastes nasty and that wasn't strong enough. You know, when I wanted to get drunk and when I was drinking, it was liquor because I felt like that was the most powerful alcohol out there, because when I was young, that's when I first tasted was vodka. And it felt like to me, it was the strongest one of the alcohols. You know, some people had their wine or some people did beer. But for me, liquor was the most powerful one for me. And, you know, I would say, oh, I'm just going to have this little Hennessy. You know, you're at the ABC store and they got the little small little bottles, right? So I would say, okay, well, I'm going to get two and I should be good for a night. Soon as I opened up that bottle and that smell hit me and it went down my throat, oh, that was over. That was it. I was going to get fucked up. I mean, to the point where you had to carry me out at the party or carry me out wherever I was. I never went to the bar. It's crazy because I thought, you know, the bar was this cool place because I knew, you know, everybody went and, you know, you could get beer and stuff there. But I was never in my drinking. I never went to a bar. It was either always at a friend's house or just outside. The bar never really attracted me because I couldn't even get to the bar, because before I could even step to the party, I was already halfway, couldn't even walk. So the bar was a no-no, you know, it was like, no, I'm not going to go to a bar, but I'm going to drink here and know that I will not get caught, because if I'm at a friend's house or I'm out in apartments, I'm not going to get caught because I'm not going to be out to the public, you know. So I thought I was smart. I thought I was a smart alcoholic, but I wasn't that smart, because every time I drank, I got into trouble. So obviously I wasn't that smart. But, you know, like you were saying, when I was drinking, I was the most tallest guy. You know, I'm short. I'm not that tall. But I thought I was the most tallest guy. I was the biggest guy out there. I could take any girl. I mean, I'm telling you, this guy could be 5'9", 300 pounds. I wasn't afraid, because that alcohol gave me courage I had when I wasn't sober. It gave me self-confidence. It gave me that image in my crazy head that I thought I was when I was drinking. Because without that drink, I was none of those things. So not only did it take away that pain and that hurt from childhood to up, it also gave me that false reality of somebody that I wasn't. And people would tell me all the time, you're a different person. You're a different person. And I'll be like, no, I'm not. I'm the same person. They're like, no, you're a different person. And it's bad. I got told that a couple of times, but I didn't think nothing of it, because I thought, you're trying to tell me what I am, and you're trying to tell me what to do. And I'm not having that, because I'm an alcoholic. I don't like when you tell me what to do, because I'm going to do my way. And my way is the best way. You know, I didn't like being told what to do. And, you know, that craving and that insane expecting the same result was expecting the same result, but it's insanity by going back to the same thing and that same thing and over and over. No matter how bad I got hurt, I went out and did the same thing, the same thing, and the same thing, because to me it made sense. But the people around me are like, "You need help. You need help, because you're not okay." And you know, when I was drunk, I would say stuff out of my mouth that was out of hurt, and it came from childhood. It came with my mom. It came with losing 3 people to alcohol and stuff like that. So it also gave me that courage to kind of speak out for help. But at the time, I didn't know I was doing that because I was drunk. I thought I was just having a good time, you know. And until I could fully commit myself and I was an alcoholic when I came to these rooms, then that's when I finally was able to look myself in the mirror and say, okay, 1 or 2 choices. You either do this and you either get sober, and you commit your life to this and put it above your family, your friends, your job, or you can have a second option and you're gonna be right beside your cousin, your uncle, your aunt. You know, that was my choice. And, you know, I finally woke up and said, you know, there's gotta be more than life than alcohol. There's gotta be so much more than life than alcohol. You know, there's got to be a life that's filled with happiness, joy, and peace and serenity. You know, there has to be, because I don't have much more left to go, because I'm at the point where suicide was my story. I mean, even before I was drinking, suicide was always part of my story, because I didn't feel like I had a purpose or a place to be in this world. And I thought God made a mistake. God made a mistake when my mom and my dad made me. I never believed that I deserved to be on this earth and to have all these things that they're talking about in these rooms, because also my mom and my dad divorced when I was young. So, you know, I thought, you know, I was a mistake. You know, I wasn't supposed to be born at all. You know, why did you give birth to me? I didn't want to live. It was too hard to live, to wake up every morning, to look at myself in the mirror and say, okay, what did you do this time? What's the next pain that you created on yourself? You know, I didn't want to do that. And, you know, my first 30 days, that thought went away. It went away because I saw that y'all are just like me. We're all alcoholics. We all have the same problem. We all want the same thing in life because we're fighting this disease every single day. And that common among us alcoholics is what made me believe that, you know what, you're worth something. You're worth getting sober and having a good life. You're worth that. You deserve that. You know, you're not this big old bad person that we all think we are when we come to these rooms. You know, you're not that person. And God forgives. He forgives sinners. He forgives. No matter what you do, he forgives. And I'll never forget, I was sitting with my sponsor and I did my inventory. And I said, I'm done. He said, wow, that's all? I was like, what do you mean that's all? He said, that ain't nothing. That's simple word. That ain't nothing. And I thought, what do you mean that nothing? You know, I was mad because I was like, I thought I really did some stuff when I was drinking. You know, I really went out there and gave it my all. He's like, no. He said, you know, you're not the first person that's done these things in your life. You know, you're not. And when that man looked at me and said, you know, you're deserving of a good life, of a happy, joyous, and free life, that hit my heart, because suicide is part of my story, because I never thought I deserved his love and his forgiveness until I got into these rooms. And I got this. Well, I don't got it, because if I got it, that's when I'm going to start thinking I go out there and drink. But I have the understanding, I have the tools and the principles and these people in these rooms to keep me sober. And as long as I do my work and my part, he will keep on giving me everything I need in my life and blessing me every single day. And he gives me direction. You know, today I have a job. You know, I'm able to hold down a job more than 5 months or 6 months because somebody made me mad. You know, I'm paying bills. I'm being an adult, because when I was drinking, my money went to weed and alcohol. I wasn't thinking about my future or wanting a car or wanting things that, you know, somebody my age in their 20s wants when they get to that age. I didn't care about that because I wasn't going to think I was going to make it to 26. I thought I was going to either kill myself or end up in an institution for the rest of my life, because that's where I was going. And, you know, today I watch people that don't believe in God or as you understand him at all. And they come in these rooms and they do. It might take them a while, but they do. They see that there is a God that loves them unconditionally, that forgives them and wants them to have a good life. And, you know, I didn't find that in no church. I found it in here. And, you know, my thing is, you think you're a bad person when you get in these rooms, but you're really not. And, you know, underneath all these scars we have as alcoholics and addicts, there are good people. There's a good person in there. We just been hurt and we've been scarred and we've been beat down to where we can't get up, that we have to ask for help. But there's a good person in there. You know, you just have to dig. You have to dig in there and you have to do this work and this inventory, and you'll see God made you into his image, which means you're not a mistake, and he loves you, and he wants you to have a good life, like in these books that we talk about. You know, I'm just grateful to be here. I really am, because every day I have to do this program, because every day when I go to sleep, that's another day I didn't drink. You know, it doesn't matter if you have 30 or 40 years. Every day you have to wake up and you have to practice these principles and these steps so you don't drink for that day. You know, I used to sit there and ask my sponsor, you know, well, you know, I can't wait till I'm 5 years sober. I can't wait till I'm 6 years sober. And he looked at me and he said, why are you trying to chase the future when you only have today? And I was like, wow. You know, I was trying to rush my life because I wanted it to be over. You know, I got this feeling of being okay and I wanted everything all at once, but I had to learn it had to come at its own timing. And he gives us what we need at his timing when we're ready. And today I have a vehicle that I bought with my money that my parents didn't have to help me buy. You know, I have money in the bank that if something happens, I can take care of it. You know, when I was drinking, I didn't care to save. I just wanted to spend so I could go get my next drunk, you know, and that's what I was chasing. I was chasing my next drunk, because the first time that I got drunk, I wanted that feeling again, and I could never get that feeling again, no matter how much I drank and how many times I did it. I was trying to chase that drunk the first time, but I could never get there. And all I was doing was killing myself, and I was going insane trying to chase that drunk. And, you know, today I don't have to do that. And today I don't have to drink, and that's all I got.
Dan, recovered alcoholic. Mm-hmm. I'll just briefly reiterate what James is saying. Every day I defy expectation. And I say that because my sponsor told me very early on, I've got one expectation of you, Dan, that you're going to drink. Why? Because you're an alcoholic, and that's what alcoholics do. So every day, and I was like, oh, my stubborn streak came out. I said, I will show you.
Yep.
So I seek every day to defy my sponsor's expectation by surrendering to actionable steps that I don't want to take. And when I do that, I do get to live my life happy, joyous, and free one day at a time from alcohol. Everything that I've either lost or given up as a result of my drinking has come back into my life in a cheeky way. I like to say 12-fold. The 12 steps have simply led me out of self and into service. And I'll leave you with this. If you have not yet had or taken the opportunity to pray the third step prayer with another alcoholic, I feel sorry for you. I hope that you get and take that opportunity. Thanks for having us tonight.
All right, everybody, that will end the reading and sharing for tonight. It then would have passed the seventh tradition basket. All right, the seventh tradition states every AA group ought to be fully Self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their inner group, the central office, local services, district area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meetings can take place. Announcements. Are there any AA-related announcements?
Hey, Justin.
I mean, you'll volunteer to take, we've got, the goal is to get volunteering after this meeting.
All right, thank you. There was...
Hey, Ben.
Thanks, Ben.
Hey, Mike.
All right, thanks, Mike. All right, Simple Actions is a home group. If you are interested in joining our group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting, and home group members, please raise your hands. All right, we have literature over on the table to the side here. Please see any me or any home group member after the meeting if you need any of the literature. If it folds, it's free, I believe the saying goes. And anything with a binding, that costs money. But talk to myself or one of the people that had their hands raised after the meeting. Sponsorship question. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have a question or would like additional information about sponsorship, we will be available here after we close the meeting. Please feel free to talk to any of us. And you can also email info@simpleactions.net. Reminders, smokers, please use the butt can provided outside. It's the old coffee can down that way to the right when you go out the door. And please stay well away from the church doors. All meeting audio recordings and upcoming events are posted on our website, simpleactions.net. Meeting after the meeting. All are invited to attend and encouraged to join us for fellowship at the meeting after the meeting, and that will be held at
Stella's.
All right, and in closing, I'd like everybody to please thank our panelists, James and Dan, for speaking. And after the Lord's Prayer, everybody will have a chance to thank them personally. And has volunteered to read.
Hey, David.
What you can do each day, the man who is still sick, the answer will come if your own house is in. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. Mm-hmm. See to it that your relationship with him is right. Great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit. You surely need some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Thank you, David. All right, then circle up around the tables. Everybody that wants to. Who keeps us sober?
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven.
Give us this day our daily bread,
and forgive us our trespasses,
as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation,
but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Come back.